Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation I-Corps Training Program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, some name changes in Iowa taking place in an effort to right some old wrongs. But first, Erica Billerbeck became a conservation officer partially because she loves nature. But protecting land and wildlife is just a small part of this challenging law enforcement job. She's worked in Johnson County for many years and encountered challenges ranging from the heartbreaking to the bizarre. And yes, sometimes hilarious, too. She has lived through epic flooding, saved lives, and witnessed terrible loss. She's written about her experiences in the new book, Wildland Sentinel, Field Notes from an Iowa Conservation Officer. And she is on the line with me now. Hello, Erica.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here. And as I mentioned, you were drawn to this line of work partially because you love nature so much. But early in your career, you were a naturalist. You were an environmental educator. So I'm curious, what made you want to make the switch, transition into this law enforcement job?
Well, it kind of stemmed from when I was naturalist in the central part of the state. I kind of started to get to know the conservation officers in the area there and did some ride-alongs with them, and it just kind of appealed to me, just having a little bit of a variety each day, and I just decided to try that route for a while.
Well, and variety is kind of an understatement, so try to give us an idea of how you would describe your job.
Well, there are a lot of misconceptions about what a conservation officer does. A lot of times when people see us out in public, you know, in uniform, and the words conservation officer on our back, on our vest, they often think that we're people that are out there, like, saving animals from danger or whatever, and that's not really what we do. So basically, a conservation officer is a state peace officer, much like a state trooper or a county deputy. You know, we can work anywhere in the state and we can enforce any laws of the state, but our specialty is focusing on any of those laws that pertain to our natural resources and people recreating outside.
And you work in Johnson County. For people that aren't familiar with this part of the state, that covers Lake McBride State Park. So there's a large lake there and a forested area and trails. And you also cover the Coralville Reservoir?
That's correct, yes.
And then, in addition to that, there's another recreation area that kind of is unique in Johnson County, I think, and that's what you call the Hawkeye. Tell us about that area.
Yeah, Johnson County is a little bit unique because it does have some pretty big natural areas, and one of those is the Hawkeye Wildlife Area. It's basically kind of a floodplain for the Coralville Reservoir for the Iowa River, and it's managed by the state. And it just is it's a large wildlife area that's kind of set between Cedar Rapids and Iowa City, so it draws a lot of people from actually all over the place, but specifically those two places. And it's a constant place for me to be, where I can always find something to do at Hawkeye, I guess is how I'll put it.
Well, and part of the reason for that is because the rules that apply at state parks are pretty clear. That doesn't mean you never have any trouble in a state park. But with this recreation area, people seem to be a little unclear about what the rules are.
Well, yeah, it's just a different set of rules, just like there would be, you know, regulations applied to any state-owned area or federally-owned area. There are with wildlife areas, but it's just different than a state park. It's a little less, you know, it's managed for wildlife, and it's managed for hunting and fishing and those types of activities. So the rules that apply are going to be different than they are in a state park.
And people tend to break even those rules in this area. You have, it sounds like throughout your time managing this area, a lot of people illegally camping or using the land in some really creative ways.
Yeah, that's one way to put it.
So why don't you shed a little bit of light on this for us? Because I was honestly shocked. And you know, I live in Johnson County, and my kids have gone to wildlife camp, and we have spent a lot of time in this management area, this recreation area, and had some wonderful, wonderful experiences. But over the years, you have witnessed some really fascinating things, that a really cultural phenomenon that have developed in this area. And one of them, you set out to clean up something that had been going on for a very long time, was a part of the park where people met for illicit activities.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of stuff that happens at Hawkeye and really any wildlife area, you know, across the country. You get just unique things happening, and that section of Hawkeye we had a lot of complaints about, and in addition to many other problems we had out there, and just decided that we needed to probably do something about it so that people could, you know, go for a walk or go hunting in that section of timber and not feel like they were going to encounter something they didn't want to encounter.
All right. And you were significantly more explicit in your book about the kinds of things that people were encountering. But it was not unusual to run into nude people or people engaged in sex acts or people using illegal drugs in this part of the park. So you have had to take on situations that I feel would be wildly uncomfortable. And I'm sure everybody who works in law enforcement has had to do that as well. You wrote about your encounters in that part of the park, but also a large part of your job is dealing with intoxicated people who are doing dangerous things. So were you prepared for that when you took on this job?
Well, I mean, to a point, but I think that over the years, I mean, the job has changed quite a bit. And part of that, I think, is just, you know, comes with the changes that happen in society in general. But, you know, people bring their problems with them where they go, whether that's to a state park or whether that's to a state wildlife area. And, you know, they don't just leave their problems at the entrance gates and, you know, just recreate and do everything perfectly. So, you know, they bring their alcohol issues, they bring drugs, they bring, you know, maybe warrants for their arrest or other legal problems and mental illness and things like that. So oftentimes we're the ones that are left trying to sort through those problems with the people that are using the areas.
Well, it seems like these areas are a refuge for people, but they're a refuge for people in different ways. Of course, many people go to these natural areas because they're looking for solitude and they're looking for time in nature. But so many of the people that you write about are drawn to these natural areas because they need to get away from people because they do have something maybe illegal going on or something else terrible going on. That seems like a really strange dynamic for you to have to deal with.
Yeah, and it's the majority of the people using the areas are not, you know, a problem or causing lots of issues, but there are a handful that, you know, it just becomes a larger and larger problem when you're compounding their problems with alcohol and drugs and, you know, all kinds of different activities that they probably shouldn't be doing in public.
You share some, well, I guess they're funny stories, although there's also a sad angle really to almost all of the stories that you share in this book. Were you worried at all about sharing some of these tales that maybe you were sharing too much about the things that really happen in your line of work?
Well, I did, you know, when I wrote the book, I made sure that I wasn't going to be able to have somebody be identified by, you know, reading about them. So I've changed, you know, identifying details about people, and I've changed all the names in the book. But there were sections where I was a little bit you know, I think it's important for the stories to be told, and I think it's important for people to know what we do and what's happening out in our public areas. But yeah, there was times when I was a little bit hesitant to write, but I think the way it turned out, I think was okay for people to hear those types of stories, because they're all the stories in the book are real. Like you said, some are funny. Yeah, I mean, you have to have a sense of humor doing this job, but some of them aren't funny at all. There's a lot of tragedies that happen, so it was difficult to write about them, but I think it was important to write about them.
You also describe there's sort of a cultural phenomenon within your field of work, and I won't use the term that you use, but there are some officers that just seem to always encounter the most challenging and bizarre situations, and you don't feel that you are one of those officers. Tell me a little more about that phenomenon.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but some people just seem to attract, I guess, activities, or they're just always in the right place at the right time, and I am never in the right place at the right time. So sometimes if I'm getting bored driving around, you know, it helps to kind of maybe meet up with an officer that I know tends to get into more stuff. So, I don't know why some people have that magnetic ability, but I certainly don't think I do.
All right. But you do work closely with at least one officer who does.
Yeah, the park ranger out at Lake McBride State Park is definitely one of those folks.
And just give me an idea about what you mean. You know, what might he encounter that you wouldn't? And we only have about a minute here before our break, so we'll pick back up when we get back. But give me an idea.
Oh, I mean, one story in the book, he just happens to have stuff fall in his lap. That's unusual things. I mean, he stopped a car once in the state park that had somebody was driving around with their kids. One of the kids is in the trunk, one of the kids is on the roof, and you know, it was just a normal thing for him to encounter. It's just all kinds of strange things he just happens into, and it's just in the normal course of his duties.
All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Erica Billerbeck. She is the author of the new book, Wildland Sentinel, Field Notes from an Iowa Conservation Officer. We'll talk about what it's like to be one of the few women county conservation officers in the state of Iowa and many of the experiences she's had on the job in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll talk about some name changes taking place in Iowa in an effort to right some old wrongs. But with me right now is Erica Billerbeck. She is the author of the new book, Wildland Sentinel, Field Notes from an Iowa Conservation Officer. And she works as a conservation officer in Johnson County. She has for many years. And Erica, before the break, we were talking about some of the stranger situations that a conservation officer can find themselves in. Your responsibilities are vast. I mean, in the summer, I mentioned that you encounter a lot of people who are intoxicated in different situations. So in the summer, you spend a lot of your time on the Coralville Reservoir looking out for drunk boaters. And as we were talking about how some of the situations can be funny, I'm sure there are many encounters that are funny, but also you write about some really horrible, dangerous, and even fatal experiences you've had. Just tell me first, how prevalent a problem is this of people out on the water, very drunk and operating a boat?
It's a significant problem, and that's not just in Iowa. For some reason, you know, people just think that boating and drinking go kind of hand in hand. And really, it's, you know, it's not any different than somebody driving a car. And in fact, sometimes can be even, you know, more tragic if they were to get in an accident, you know, caused by alcohol, just because boats tend to carry a lot more people than a vehicle does. So, people are not as familiar with regulations, you know, as far as operating a boat as they are operating a vehicle. So, it's definitely a problem, and it's something that I've really tried to focus on, you know, during the summer months of my career. It's a very seasonal dependent job. So during the summer, that is where I spend most of my time, is on a boat, whether that's the Coralville Reservoir or the Mississippi or the, you know, Lake McBride Lake. So it's definitely an issue.
Well, and I think a lot of people think, oh, it's not that big a deal having a few beers when you're out on the water. That's just fun. Everybody does it. You write about some really terrible things that you've witnessed. Has your understanding, your feeling about how important it is to be sober when you're operating a boat, has that changed over your years of experience?
Well, I was definitely woken up. I think several years ago, that I write about in the book, there was a fatality on the Coralville Reservoir involving a young girl. And I think from that moment on, it really kind of just made me aware that we really need to put the hammer down on drunk boating, just to hopefully prevent something similar from happening again. So since that year, I really have increased my intoxicated boater enforcement on the reservoir, and really that's one of the areas where there's no warnings given for an impaired driver. They go to jail is what happens when I catch them.
Well, the little girl that you write about, she was just out tubing with a friend. She fell off and was run over by a boat and mangled and killed. And experiencing moments like that, how does that change you? You're a person, you're a mother. How does that change you to deal with a situation like that?
It's not easy. It's something that I think a lot of people don't really realize when they think about a law enforcement officer or a first responder or somebody like that. I mean, we see a lot of things, but that doesn't mean that just because we see a lot of things that it doesn't affect us. After that accident happened, I mean, I had a hard time sleeping, just kept replaying what I saw in my mind over and over. And so I think that, you know, writing about it helped, and also just made me more determined to stop stuff from happening like that again.
You also deal with a lot of poaching. That's something that happens a lot more in the fall and winter months. For people who may not know about this subculture, tell us a little bit more about poaching and how common it is.
Well, yeah, so the fall season, hunting season, kind of starts the time where I sort of transition away from the water and move out more into the fields and, you know, public wildlife areas and private areas too, wherever hunting takes place. So basically, a lot of people think of a conservation officer as somebody that's going out and just checking to make sure people have a hunting license. And that is part of what we do. We do compliance checks to make sure that people are following the regulations that we have set to, you know, protect the wildlife in the state. But the other part of that is that you're also really looking for problems with people that are maybe taking too many of a species, taking them out of season, basically anything illegally done as far as like using the wrong type of weapon or anything like that is considered poaching. And it's something that a lot of people don't really think about, I guess, but it is a problem, and it's something that we really work hard to stop.
Well, and you write about a couple of cases that you filed charges on and followed through with, and some really grisly and sad stories that you share. But also you write about really the extent that some of these poachers will go to lie about what they're doing and cover their tracks, except that almost universally, people who do this feel the need to brag about it through social media. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that is something that's definitely changed since I was hired in 2000. There was no social media back then, so people were content to kind of, you know, I guess maybe brag or boast about, you know, what they did, you know,
right,
at the bar.
Right, go to the bar and tell a story.
Yeah,
right,
go to the coffee shop. But now that, you know, it's really, people are after likes on Facebook or on Instagram or whatever, and just can't resist posting, you know, what they did. And maybe they try to hide the parts that they did wrong, but there's a lot of perceptive people out there that will alert us to some problems that they're seeing on social media, and we can kind of go after them from that route.
Well, and you can get a warrant to search somebody's phone, right?
Yeah, depending on the situation, yeah. Yep, definitely.
So if you get a warrant to search somebody's phone, you find not just on social media, but that they have documented in great detail the crime they've committed.
Yeah, it's weird that it just seems like the search warrants on phones that I've been part of, you know, people are really having a hard time just being out in nature on their hunt without constantly, you know, recording what they're doing on their phone, whether it's by text messages to friends or by videos or whatever. They just can't sit. They've got to be constantly dictating what they're doing. So it's helpful from the law enforcement end, but it's also kind of a little bit disturbing that, you know, we've gotten to a point where we can't just be out and experience the hunt or experience nature as it is without having to tell everybody about it on your phone at the time.
Yeah, well, that's not a problem that's limited to hunting or spending time in natural areas, obviously. I'm talking with Erica Billerbeck. She's the author of the new book, Wildland Sentinel, Field Notes from an Iowa Conservation Officer. And we're talking about her work as a conservation officer in Johnson County with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. And Erica, to continue talking about poaching, one of the cases that you write about, there was a young man who had recorded everything on his phone, and you did get a search warrant for his phone, and so you were able to uncover the crime that he'd committed. But you took that to court and found that the court basically dismissed everything that you had very carefully collected. Tell me about that process and how often that happens.
Well, it's one of the frustrations of, I think, working in any law enforcement job. You know, you may spend, in that case, you know, several months working on an investigation and really putting a lot of time into the case to make sure that you have everything you need to, you know, show that this person really violated these wildlife laws. And I think sometimes that maybe it gets to the prosecutor's office, and it's just not, you know, wildlife crimes are not really ranking real high on their list of all the other cases that they have. So plea bargains happen, and it's just a very frustrating process for the person on my end of it who's done a lot of work to and really cares about, you know, the case, and to have it just kind of pled out without any real consequences for the person who committed the crimes.
How do you feel these kinds of crimes are seen in our culture? I mean, obviously, you feel like this is a very serious thing. And one of the young men that you write about, he didn't even have his hunting rights revoked for a year, which was your hope that that's what would happen to him. Do you think that there's a cultural problem where we just don't take this seriously?
Well, I'm not sure, I guess. Maybe it's just a matter of priorities, and I think it's also a little bit dependent on the county. You know, when you're in a county that has a lot of other, you know, serious issues, you know, or what could be viewed as more serious issues in terms of, you know, violent crime and things like that, that it just tends to rank a little bit lower because, you know, the county attorneys are busy with other cases. So there are other counties where maybe wildlife crimes do rank a bit higher on their list of on their list of priorities. So I think it just depends. But I hope by writing about some of this stuff in the book that people gain an understanding of just how big of a problem wildlife crime is in our state.
You write about the fact that you've been at this for 20 years and the force that you're a part of, county conservation officers in Iowa, is a pretty uniform community. You are all white, and very few of you are women. What was it like for you as a woman to enter this world?
Well, so just a little bit of a distinction. There are county conservation officers which are employed by county conservation boards. I work for the state, so I'm a state conservation officer. With the state, right now I think we've got, if I counted right, I think we have 6 females working for us at the moment as law enforcement officers. And that's out of, 70-some officers. So I think if you were to look at conservation law enforcement nationwide, the number of women, or I can't say minorities for sure, but I know the number of women is much lower than even regular law enforcement, city police officer jobs or county deputies and things like that. So it's definitely always feel as a female that you're kind of under the microscope a bit more than your male counterparts. You have to prove yourself and show that you really can do this job, even though you may have to do it, some parts of it, a little bit differently than your male colleagues.
Have you felt supported by your male colleagues?
There are definitely officers that I have felt supported by. There's always challenges, and every female conservation officer I've ever talked to, there's been moments where you feel very unsupported, but I've always been able to seek out officers that, really treated me equally and treated me with respect and asked for my opinion on their cases. And so as long as you can find a few officers that, support you, I think you can do okay. But it is not easy, and I don't want it to make it sound like everything is wonderful, because there's times when it's not. So it's been a challenge.
Well, and hunting culture in Iowa is also dominated by men. Have you felt a lack of respect from the hunters that you encounter, people that weren't expecting to see a woman conservation officer?
Actually, not really. I think that, the reception I've had from the public and the hunters that I encounter has really always been pretty positive. I mean, I haven't felt like they've been treating me any differently, or at least, I mean, they may treat me a little bit differently, but not really in a negative way. So I think that in general, the public is pretty okay with having female conservation officers. It's just a matter of changing the mindset within law enforcement agencies that there is more than one way to do this job, and women can do it just as well as men can, even though historically, we haven't really been there in the numbers that the men have.
In the beginning of the book, you write about not even necessarily understanding why you were drawn to this line of work and whether it was the right place for you. You've really grown into this role. What do you think now about your job and about your mission in what you do? Why is this the right place for you?
Well, I mean, I think it's the right place for a few reasons. It's just really been, I'm just trying to think of how to word this. It's been a challenge, but I think that if I try to keep the big picture in mind as far as what my goal is, my goal is to protect the natural resources of the state and protect the people who use those natural resources. I try to keep both the big picture in mind to kind of motivate me to get to work each day, but also having individual, contacts with people that are out using our areas makes a difference too. So if I can make a difference, one person at a time, how can I contact or deal with this person today that's going to make them walk away from this encounter with me in a positive way, and in a way that's going to make them, hopefully treat our natural resources with respect. I think that that's kind of what keeps me going, is just being able to focus on each person and keep the big picture in mind.
You also do your work in a job that doesn't have a great deal of public land. And I know a lot of us feel that the public land that we do have is precious. What do you want readers, just very briefly, to take away from your stories?
Just that even though Iowa does not have like vast expanses of wilderness, what we do have is unique and is worth our time. And I think that's what I try to focus on, is that, you know, we need to protect what we do have and treat it with care.
Well, Erica, thank you so much for sharing your stories in your book and for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Erica Billerbeck is the author of the new book, Wildland Sentinel, Field Notes from an Iowa Conservation Officer. She works in Johnson County for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, and she lives in Solon, Iowa. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about a couple of name changes that have taken place recently in Iowa. Name changes designed to right some old wrongs. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.